House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Colleagues, this morning, it's our plan to see if we can work the three work session bills and then do our public hearings. And what I'd like to do first is open the work session on House Bill 2543, go over this amendment, the dash 4, I think it is, if it's right, to send it out, if we can muster the constitutional requirements to accomplish that. Is revenue here? Yeah. Why don't you come up and we have our conversation about this the dash 4, and I'd like to go through it since we haven't seen it before this morning, sort of section by section, and make sure that we've got it right. Since I don't think anybody has actually seen this written version until this morning. And I guess we're going to have to look at some of the extraneous statutes, too, because I see we've changed some definitions. Shall I lead the discussion on this, or do you want to do it?
Either way.
All right. Why don't we do it? Any questions on the first page? I have one on ORS 310.630, household income. Can you tell us what that statute says?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. That is, Mr. Chair, the definition of household income is referring to the definition that's used in the ERA program, the Elderly Rental Assistance Program, and that's the definition we've always linked to. It's just been moved.
And that's a broad definition?
Yes,
of income.
Broad.
Mm-hmm. Given the discussion we had earlier.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Then on page 2, I'm interested in understanding why sub 9 is there and why it makes a difference what a transferee is and what a transferee is not. And where we use that definition somewhere later on in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I believe that definition was added so that we could effectuate the concern about getting once the senior is passed on, let's say, and the property transfers to an heir, that heir could be a person, it could be a son or a daughter, it could be an entity, trust, and various other things that legislative council thought would be better to clarify in this. And that way, when we brought in the concept to add collection tools for the department to collect, that we could go to what's called the transferee, and that's how LC described it.
Okay. And that's somewhere later on in the bill.
Yes, it is.
Yes, Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question is, I see it's on page, further on the bill is page 24, but the question is, the lien apparently remains in place. It's not a lien, I guess. Well, the obligation remains in place if the home is transferred to a transferee. Then what happens, though? I know that the bona fide purchaser is not a transferee, so someone sells it. How do we make sure we get paid? I can't remember if we were of record, so that if the person passes away, the house is sold to a bona fide purchaser, the money comes back to the beneficiaries. How do we make sure they pay?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, typically then what happens is the title company will pay us in the disposition of the whatever it's called, assets, or I'm not sure the correct
closing.
Term. In the closing, yes. And that's how we're typically paid today and have been traditionally, is just that we get a check from the title company.
Yeah, please. Right. And then I'm just trying to understand what it is the title company sees of record that would make them pay us. Do they see what do we record when we do this deferral?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, we record a lien for the amount of the amount loaned on the property.
Follow up.
Yes.
And that happens every year, just once? How do we do it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, there's an estimate that's done. It's provided for in the bill or in current law. There's an estimate that's done, and then that estimate is then updated. If the amount of the loan eclipses that lien, then we routinely will go in and revise that lien up to the amount, up to 100% of the value of the home, I believe it is.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions or comments on page 3? Looks to me like that's mostly kind of updating and removing obsolete language. So it's interesting how LC finds other things they can fix in a statute whenever we open one.
That's true. Very true.
I'm reading ahead the next couple of pages. While looking at the bottom of page 4, I'm assuming the household income of $32,000 is an old number that's indexed based on July 1, 2002, something like that,
right?
Or maybe some other year.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. It is indexed.
And the actual amount is
elsewhere in the bill.
Yeah, and the actual amount is more like $39,500.
For this tax year, the amount is $39,500, correct?
Right. Okay.
And it grows or changes up or down in increments of $500 depending on the CPI index.
Right, and that's defined earlier. We already passed it. Okay. How do we ascertain that the property is insured for fire and other casualty? I'm looking at page 6.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is a new provision which we have not implemented before. It was something that came up actually last session. You might recall there was a bill to change the historic property tax freeze that was added to as a requirement to historic property homes, and that idea came up in this thinking because the discussion had turned to, well, how do we secure our lien? How do we collect? And if the house burns down, we don't have any equity. And so it was just an idea to put that in there. So to answer your question, we would probably use the same technique we're going to use to get to most of these issues and just put it in the application and require the person to retain it.
Right. So you'll ask them who their carrier is, what the coverage is, and what the policy number is.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Any questions on the next little bit, which is the real market value scale?
Mr. Chair, I should point out the Dash 4 amendment has required that the person own and live in the homestead for at least the amount of time required to get the RMB limit that applies.
Okay.
And previously it was just a requirement that they had lived in the home, and this requires that they've actually owned the home.
Oh, continuously owned and lived, yeah.
Correct, and that's a difference in the Dash 4.
Right. And that deals with one of the issues we discussed last time we had the work session open.
Okay.
All right. I'm on page 8.
To 10, we're good.
Okay, so on page 9, that's where the cap in the number of claims is contained.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's true.
In the Dash 4 amendment, there's also a provision that spouses who continue deferral after the other spouse has died or moved away for some reason are not considered initial applicants for the purposes of this 5% limit. So they would
But they would still have to reapply, but they just wouldn't have come in as new applicants, and so the building up of the value of the home, they won't have to start all over again with that.
Correct, and the 5% limit would not apply to them.
Exactly. But they still have to apply and qualify.
Okay, now, in this measure, the measuring year is next year. Is that right?
Correct.
Line 7, page 9.
Yes, it's the number of new applicants in 2011 is the base for this limit.
Okay.
End of the future.
That wasn't our plan, was it?
Yes.
It was? Okay.
Was mine.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure we had
I don't know what your plan was, but that was my plan.
There are so many moving parts and so many details to this piece that I just wanted to make sure that we had it clear. Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so looking on page 9, B subsection C starting on 16, so if we have applications that exceed the 105%, it looks like the filtering starts at, if I read this right, I just want to make sure this is the right policy that we want. Claims shall be granted in ascending order based on the amount of tax imposed on the homestead entered on the last certified assessment date until the maximum number determined under, you know, the limit is there. So we're going to give priority to the lower tax properties. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eric Brewer, that was what was requested in the draft, yes.
Okay.
What that does, of course, is keep our liabilities as low as we can manage.
Maximum number.
It also...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
If I understand this correctly, it would also then make sure that folks who have a less valuable property and therefore less income base would be first in. Am I right about that? In other words, the less fancy homes... which means that their total estate, they would be poorer in terms of having a total value of assets because their homes are less valuable. And I think that's a policy choice that I think is deliberate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up comment on that. If that's the policy choice, the tax imposed is different than value because of our Measure 5 and 50. So I just wanted to make sure that that this accomplishes exactly what we want, because you could have a higher valued home with the less tax.
I appreciate that, and in a perfect world, we would go into great and enduring detail here, but I don't think it's a perfect world, and I think we're getting at the policy choice this way and without getting too deep into all of the... I mean, you're absolutely right in that. But I think we're getting at the policy this way in a simpler and more direct way than trying to hire staff to go into all of that. Does that make sense?
I think that the comment is as much a comment on the
complications
and failures of our current property tax system as it is on the bill, if I could editorialize that way.
Yes, thank you for saying what I was trying to say. The complications of our tax system is such that we could expend a lot of staff time analyzing the tax statements of all of these properties, and that would probably not get us any closer, or it might get us a little closer to our policy goal, but this will get us there without quite as many complications, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Representative
Benz. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, after that last exchange, I'm afraid that I'm going to have to wander into the perfect world of lawyers and CPAs.
Oh, no.
Out of you guys' world. on page 10 and 11, I'm just curious, is the interest accruing on the deferred, what is the interest accruing on? I noticed that top of page 10, paragraph 3, it says the interest shall accrue on the actual amount of taxes advanced to the county. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, that's correct.
Okay. And then on the next page, page 11, line 11, it says interest on the deferred taxes. Are those one and the same?
Mr. Chair, yes. Representative Vance. you know, sometimes people talk about deferred taxes, and we often, well, we talk about this as a deferred tax program, but the taxes in every case are paid. So actually it's deferred reimbursement, basically, but that is the same. We're talking about the same thing here. So once we pay the taxes of a senior or disabled person in this program, that's when the clock starts ticking on the interest. And that's the only thing that accrues interest, and it's the loan, and it's also essentially, effectively, the deferred tax for that person.
I actually think they're different, but they're the same amount.
It should be.
Right. But it's interesting because if you look at the two, we are making a loan and charging interest on that loan, basically, mm-hmm. back. And that loan is not the deferred taxes. That's the amount we loan to pay the deferred tax.
That's correct.
And so just as long as the fact that I think they are different doesn't create a problem with our lien, I'm okay with it.
Okay.
Has this issue been litigated?
Not to my knowledge. We've not had an issue with this. The lien is treated as something other than a tax lien, as we've talked about previously.
Well, I guess it depends, Representative Bence, at which point of view you're looking at it from. If you're looking at it from the point of view of the assessor, the taxes are paid. If you're looking at it from the point of view of the homeowner, he's deferred payment on them. So it looks like everybody has interpreted that language not to literally mean taxes deferred, but taxes the homeowner hasn't paid yet.
Hi, Mr. Chair.
Please.
It seems to me that the amount that we advance back to the county is in essence a loan we're making to the homeowner.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, yes.
And on that loan, we would charge interest.
That's correct.
And if we chose to call the loan deferred taxes, then I guess this would make sense. This being the language that appears on page 11, because then we go down into line 18 and we talk about if during the period of the deferral the amount of taxes, interest, and fees, and the interest we're referring back to is the interest on the loan.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
To pay the taxes that have been deferred.
Yeah. Right. And this would concern me, Representative, if we hadn't been using essentially the same language for a long time.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think we've muddled around in it enough to make the intent clear that we want to charge interest on whatever it is we're loaning.
Right. And I appreciate your comments about that. If it ever gets to the tax court, I want to make sure that Court of Appeals, I want to make sure that they can read your questions and comments and understand it that way. Yes, we want the interest and the repayment of the amounts we've paid. Yeah. Representative Brewer.
Thank you. So to follow up on Representative Cliff Bence's questioning, so in our lien rights, the interest is included in the lien rights, and I just want to put that on the record. So it's not just the amount of the deferral, it's actually the interest is also subject to recovery at closing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brewer, correct.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm up to page 13. I note a number of corrections or of changes in language that I don't think make any substantial difference. And would you tell us what the circumstances listed in 311.684 are? I'm looking at line 26 on page 14. Actually, I don't need to do that because right above that is that section.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We have if the claimant dies, if property is sold, if it's no longer the homestead, if it's moved out of state. Okay. Thank you. And then on page 16, the language on the requirement for reapplication. Anybody have any questions about that part of it?
No, it's 17, too. It's for...
I'm sorry. I meant 17.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it exceeds the amounts allowable.
Okay. This is how you deal with the county's rejiggering of the taxes, right?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Which section are you
on? I was looking at page 17.
Yes, at the top of 17, we're going to that biennial review, sort of reapplication process.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Rose.
So we're talking about recertification every 2 years. What happens when we have an eligible property that due to income thresholds and such goes in and out of qualifying? When they're out of qualifying, does this say that the deferred years that they had that they have to make good on them immediately, or do those continue to stay in deferral but only the current years for which they no longer qualify then start falling to normal payment? What happens in those years if they fall in and out of it over a period of time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eric Brewer, what happens is the account, and this happens quite frequently even under current law, is that the account goes in what we would call inactive, and at that point nothing is really due. They have to pay their current year's taxes and prospectively, but all of the money that we have loaned and the interest that's accruing sort of is, it's just what we would call inactivated. It's not technically due. We don't start collection. And then once they, as the chair pointed out earlier, once they die or sell the home, one of those conditions occur, that's when the taxes become due, deferred taxes become due, and the collection starts. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. Mr. Chair, follow-up comment. Maybe
please.
In the future we might, not this bill, it's too far gone here, but we might want to consider if they don't qualify for a period of time, rather than waiting potentially for a long period of time for the sale of the home or death, that there might be another triggering event to require. For example, if their income does sizably increase mm-hmm. for so many years, that then we start seeking recovery of the deferred payments.
I think that might make sense if it looks like the account isn't recovering as quickly as we expected that it would. Then that might be reasonable. Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Compound interest is a powerful incentive, though. I mean, if somebody ends up with $125,000 a year in income that they weren't expecting, you know, you'd want to pay that $3,000 or $4,000 tax liability to avoid the compound interest. So there's some incentive, not as good as a structure, I suppose.
It's annual compound.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Page 10.
Thank you.
Okay. It's annual compound.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Representative Wand and Representative Berger just pointed out that we changed the interest from 6% simple interest to compounded annually, page 10, line 8. I went back and looked at 311.672 since it's referred to a whole bunch of times, and that's simply section 4 on page 7, which includes a bunch of new provisions that we've already talked about. Representative Berger.
Yeah, this issue of people coming in and out, I think as we sort of get the things in process that we've put into this bill, we will have quite a bit less of that, partly because of the way the housing market is not expanding the way it was, and the income requirements on people coming into this, I think that we will see this sort of fall back to those folks who are our target, if you will, clients for this program, and that is those who have very limited income and are trying to stay in their homes. And with the ramps in terms of increase property value, I just don't believe going forward we're going to see that kind of bubbling up of property values, and I don't think we're going to see people going in and out as often as they have in the past. At least that is my policy hope within here, so that will be less of an issue.
Okay. I think that's right. I suspect that's right. But, of course, since we haven't actually required reapplications, we really don't know, do we?
Yeah. And to that, Mr.
Yeah,
Chair, I would anticipate, we don't ask for extensive reporting in here, but we meet frequently enough in this committee that I think that we will be asking for follow-up comments as this gets implemented on how this is going. We didn't watch it enough at some point, so it may be under the microscope after all the effort that's gone into this.
Right. And I'm down to page 33, which is the last page, and I note that that is the sunset, as it were, on this section, the purpose of which is to force the legislature to either, to review the program and decide what to do with it at least 10 years from now.
Exactly.
Hopefully sooner than that. any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move the -4 amendments to House Bill 2543.
Representative Berger moves the -4 amendments to House Bill 2543. Are there is there any discussion? Any objection? No objection, so ordered. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2543 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 2543 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just great thanks and appreciation to all who have worked very hard on a very important bill.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, would you like to carry this?
Yeah.
I would recommend that you do for all the work that you've put into it.
Well, may I simply add to Representative Reed and Representative Berger's comments that the co-chairs worked on a work group on this bill. We had a great deal of help from Legislative Revenue Office, the Department of Revenue, the AARP, and the
clerks.
The clerks, and especially the assessor from Multnomah County. I have to tell you that work group worked very, very hard, not the co-chairs necessarily, although we had a lot of very strong opinions about what the bill ought to look like. But they worked very hard to actually gather the data that we had to have in order to figure out whether what we wanted to do was possible or not. And we changed some of our approaches to the bill as we went along, because some of the things we thought about really weren't possible, and others came up in the conversations that were suggestions actually from other members of the work group. So this is one of those where frankly, I think the work group process worked very well. And while I think that the co-chairs would love to take full credit for this, the fact is that other people did most of the work, and we are very, very grateful for that. I think it's possible that we will be able to continue this program despite the fact that it's in serious financial trouble right now. And I wasn't at all sure about that a month ago. Any other conversation? Are there any objections to the motion, which is to send the bill to the floor with a due pass? No objections. Motion carried. Bernhardt will carry. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2543. And let's open House Bill, the work session on House Bill 2328.
Shuffle.
shuffle papers.
Shuffle, shuffle.
Shuffle staff.
Mazin.
Morning, Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee. House Bill 2328 in front of you is the A13 amendment. The last time we've discussed those, be happy to quickly say that the A13 amendment, just to remind you, is the one that had the revenue impact statement with it, and we were waiting for a fiscal statement. And the fiscal statement made it, and it's in your packets today. Fiscal statement is a little different than the revenue statement. The revenue, obviously, you could see it, that it starts coming in the 2016, because that's where we start putting the amounts of fee in this system. The implementation, however, will start in the 2011-13 biennium in the Department of Transportation because of the preparation and trying to build the system and so on. So this is the statement in front of you, and this would probably be a highway fund expenditure. No, this will be a highway fund expenditure, probably. and that's that will... I will start then, and I think if you look at that and think this is everything that we discussed last time, this vehicle might be ready to be driven off this committee.
Mr. Chair, I
was ready to go.
When I first saw these figures, I was frankly aghast. That this much money, sorry, it's a little bit of a pun. this much money would be have to be expended to implement this small tax. We're talking about tax here, but so be it. Remember, this is highway fund money out and then highway fund money in. And that's a really important point because the money that will be derived from this system will go to the highway fund, and that is the purpose because gas tax money will not be going into the highway fund under these vehicles. So I couldn't help the bad pun, but I am satisfied that the numbers are what the numbers are.
Mr. Chair, can I just quickly, you know, the collection of taxes in the highway arena, although this might look large, remember in comparison, this is not necessarily going to climb in the way that is commensurate with proportions of how this tax is going to be. Today, you have the fuel tax collection is probably one of the more efficient tax collects about $400 million for a very small amount of collection, and that might end up being that way. But, of course, when you start it, it looks because you need to do that. So it might not be as kind of charged to the system in the future as it is today.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Yeah, that is to be hoped.
Yes.
We are starting a new system, and it is to be hoped that this will be an efficient system and not a costly one to administer. And I believe that that policy discussion is in this bill, that we are being flexible in the hopes of arriving at that nirvana of a tax that has very low administrative costs and brings in a satisfactory and fair amount of taxation.
Right. Representative Brewer.
I might make a comment, not fully understanding government expenditures. The program doesn't start until 2016, so I understand we have upfront costs, but it does strike me, whether general fund or out of ODOT, other funds coming through, that we're at $2.6 million of expenditures to ramp this up with one FTE over the next biennium and then three FTEs
in the next biennium before the program starts. So that is kind of interesting to me. I'm not sure what that's for and what that means when we don't even have the program started. I just say that more as a comment than anything else.
Okay. Committee will stand at ease. Back to order.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move House Bill, the dash A13 amendments to House Bill 2328.
Representative Berger moves the dash 13 amendments to House Bill 2328. Discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion passes. Colleagues, we need some additional conversation about some of the issues that have arisen, and so we're going to close the work session on this bill, get on with our other business, and our next meeting is on Monday. Can we set it over till Monday?
Let's set it over till Monday.
All right. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2328, and are we ready on the other work session today? We are not ready, so let's go to the public hearings. Let's just take them in order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2679. Okay. Day.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, you'll see in background there's an information about what is surplus lines policy. And what this bill basically does is it makes sure that the Oregon surplus lines law, conformed to the federal law, that is about to take effect in late July. And there are a couple of elements that needs to be looked at, actually, in this bill. One is the bill imposes surplus lines tax and reporting requirements on independently procured insurance policy holders. And this is this element makes this bill requiring a three-fifth majority. And it also revises calculation method of surplus lines fire marshal tax. And before it, it was a complicated calculation method for surplus lines fire marshal tax, but it simplifies the calculation method. So there are a couple of elements that needs to be looked at closely. And we understand there are two groups, one from Surplus Line Association that intends to discuss the intent of the bill and what the bill does. And DCBS Insurance Division is here to discuss the details of the bill.
All right. So I've got two people signed up for today, so let's call them both. Good morning.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Jim Markey representing the Surplus Line Association of Oregon today, and with me is Teresa Miller, insurance commissioner, or administrator of the insurance division. I'm going to let Teresa, I think, start and give you a quick run through with the bill, and then I'd like to add some comments if that's okay.
Thank you. Please.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Miller, and I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'm here today to support the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2679, which bring Oregon surplus lines insurance laws into alignment with the provisions in the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act that address the surplus lines market. And these provisions do become effective on July 21st, 2011, and are intended to simplify the requirements related to surplus lines insurance by providing a consistent federal regulatory scheme. Surplus lines insurance typically covers those risk exposures that are not traditionally covered by admitted insurers. For example, coverage for amusement park rides or stunt actors. States have established regulations to permit the writing of insurance by what we call non-admitted insurers under certain circumstances, and this is known as the surplus lines market. Oregon's current surplus lines insurance laws include but are not limited to reporting and tax requirements and financial requirements, including capital and surplus. Dodd-Frank fundamentally changes the way in which a state can regulate a surplus lines transaction with risk exposures in more than one state. Currently, laws that apply to a surplus lines transaction vary from state to state. When a surplus lines producer or agent writes a multi-state policy, that producer must know the surplus lines laws of each of the states where there's exposure. They have to be licensed in each of those states, file transaction paperwork in each of those states, and allocate the premium and pay the fees and premium taxes due in each of those states. So it was really this situation that prompted Congress to include in the Dodd-Frank legislation provisions related to surplus lines. Under Dodd-Frank, the home state of the insured or the policyholder has exclusive authority over surplus lines transactions. The surplus lines producer must only be licensed in the insured's home state, file transaction paperwork only in the insured's home state, and pay any fees and premium taxes only to the insured's home state. So only a home state can tax a multi-state policy, but the home state can tax for liabilities of all states where there's an exposure. So let's take an example just to look at this closer. Let's say Joe's Tire Shop has its principal place of business in Oregon, but has offices throughout the Northwest. Prior to Dodd-Frank, the insurance producer selling this company a surplus lines policy would need to be licensed and file paperwork in each state where there's an exposure and allocate the premium and pay the fees and premium taxes due in each of those states. Under Dodd-Frank, because the tire shop's principal place of business is in Oregon, Oregon would be the home state, so the producer would only be required to be licensed and file paperwork in Oregon, and only Oregon could tax this multi-state policy, but it could tax for the liability of all states where there's an exposure. Dodd-Frank contemplates that each state will adopt nationwide uniform requirements that would facilitate the reporting, payment, collection, and allocation of premium taxes among the states. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, or the NAIC, has been working with stakeholders for many months to develop a multi-state agreement that states could join. However, there's no consensus yet on the form the agreement should take, and the NAIC has not completed its work. So the Dash 2 amendments authorize DCBS to enter a compact or otherwise establish procedures with other states to allocate among the states premium taxes paid to Oregon as an insured's home state that also include risk exposures in other states. So again, going back to our example, the Dash 2 amendments would allow Oregon to enter into an agreement with other states to allocate the premium taxes paid to Oregon for Joe's Tire Shop for those risk exposures located outside of Oregon. On the flip side, this amendment would allow Oregon, after entering into an agreement with other states, to collect from other states premium taxes they have collected as the home state for risk exposures located in Oregon. Dodd-Frank also authorizes states to collect premium taxes on independently procured surplus lines insurance policies, policies that are purchased directly from a surplus lines insurer rather than through a producer. The Dash 2 amendments provide this new authority to Oregon. Because Oregon does not currently require that premium taxes be paid on these policies, we don't know how many such policies are out there or how much these policies would bring to the state in terms of premium taxes or premium revenue. Dodd-Frank prohibits states from requiring a surplus lines producer to first determine whether the insurance is available from admitted insurers before writing surplus lines insurance for certain commercial purchasers, as long as the commercial purchaser receives proper disclosures and subsequently requests the surplus lines producer to write the insurance. The Dash 2 amendments revise Oregon's current diligent search requirements and broaden the federal exemption to include a larger group of commercial purchasers. The Dash 2 amendments also propose a few other changes to Oregon's surplus lines laws, including requiring the surplus lines producer to pay a premium tax of 2.3%, with the 0.3% of the tax used to maintain the office of the state fire marshal. And I believe Mr. Marquis may be talking a little bit more about that provision. Increasing the capital and surplus requirements of surplus lines insurers to be in line with the National Association of Insurance Commissioners Model Act relating to surplus lines. Allowing the Surplus Lines Association of Oregon at the request of DCBS to continue to receive and collect on behalf of the state and remit to the state premium taxes for surplus lines insurers, as well as independently procured insurance. The Insurance Division has worked very closely with the Surplus Lines Association of Oregon to develop the Dash 2 amendments and believes that these amendments allow Oregon to take a significant step toward complying with the Dodd-Frank and also provides Oregon the flexibility down the road to enter into a compact or otherwise establish premium allocation procedures among the states on multi-state surplus lines insurance policies. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Mr. Marquis. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, co-chairs, excuse me, members of the committee, Jim Marquis again, Surplus Line Association of Oregon. Our association has 105 members, 95 of whom are domiciled here, and they are all certified to sell this kind of insurance, surplus line insurance. This is a somewhat complex area, and the Dodd-Frank bill brought new provisions that were somewhat complicated to get through and figure out exactly how we were going to address them here in Oregon in our statutes to align these statutes with the Dodd-Frank bill. I want to thank the Insurance Division. Teresa and her staff have been just fabulous in including us in all of the discussions and leading to the Dash 2 amendments, and this has been about a five-month process getting here, so I really very much appreciate their cooperation with us and including us. We've done some really, what I consider really good things here in this area, and this surplus line area is an area that very few people know anything about, and why would they? Basically, if you go to a retail insurance producer or what we used to call insurance agent, and you want to buy some kind of insurance that just is not available through normal admitted carriers like State Farm or Allstate or somebody else, After doing a diligent search in the admitted market, the retail agent would then call one of our people who act as a wholesale agent with the surplus line carriers, Lloyd's of London being the most famous, but there are many of them out there. Examples of where you would wind up in this market, officers and directors insurance for nonprofits oftentimes end up in this market. Some flood, earthquake, landslide, windstorm type coverage in certain areas. Large utilities often buy surplus line coverage, Northwest Natural Gas, those kinds of people. Airport expansion projects, multinational corporations, and for a time, builder's defect was the only place you could get builder's defect insurance was in the surplus market. So we currently write in the area of $250 million a year in premiums in Oregon. That's taxed at 2%, which accrue a premium tax. That's different than the way that other insurance companies are taxed. Other insurance companies are taxed with a corporate excise tax. There's a premium tax of 2%, so that accrues to the general fund. We're not changing that. Additionally, there is a fire marshal's tax. We are changing the way we calculate the fire marshal's tax, but we believe that it's revenue neutral or very close to revenue neutral, and we did meet with the fire marshal's office, and they seemed fine with what we were doing. The way the fire marshal's tax today is calculated, you have to estimate, it's taxed at 1% of 100% of fire insurance, and then for all of the varying various kinds of liabilities, there is a different percentage that it's taxed at 1%, 1% of 60% of some other coverage. It is so convoluted and complex that what we did was to do a 10-year look back and see where that came out, and then we looked at different scenarios, including all 10 years or just 5 years. And we arrived at 0.3. If you just taxed all of these policies at 0.3%, the fire marshal will get just about the same amount of money that he does now. And he's happy, and it'll be very, very much simpler to do. And we're all about streamlining those kinds of things. And again, we thank the insurance division for that. We don't have the authority to tax independently procured insurance, and this gives us that right. As authorized by the Dodd-Frank bill, and that's important, we believe. We don't know how much money is out there because those folks that have an in-house insurance manager that buy directly from Lloyd's or somebody else don't have to give us that 2% tax, and they will under this, and we've required reporting requirements and such for them. So we think that's a good change. And then we've increased the capital and surplus requirements for surplus line carriers to do business in Oregon, and we think that's a good step forward too. So, with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions. We just think this has been a long and involved effort, and again, we thank the insurance division for working with us, and we think this is good policy for the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Bence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The so-called surplus line is the same as excess, the same as re, or is it different?
No, it's different.
Could you give just a thumbnail definition?
For those of us Mr. Chair, are you going to force me to call up my expert? Because I do have the executive director of surplus line.
For those of us who are not expert, Representative Bence, I may have anticipated something and maybe not.
No, actually, Mr. Chair, if there was a simple answer, I was fine with it. It was my next question that was the most interesting.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
So if we don't do this, what will states who do have these abilities to collect these taxes consider Oregon? Because it looks as though everyone's going to have to get on board or right. They're not going to work. Does the Dodd-Frank bill require that we do this, or is it just suggested?
Co-chairs, Representative Bence. I don't think that the Dodd-Frank bill requires us to do anything. But currently, under the current scheme of things. We tax these policies with the 2% premium tax, but we only tax them for Oregon risks, and then the agent that writes it, or the producer that writes the insurance, calculates, if you had a 10-state policy, let's say Les Schwab was going to buy a 10-state policy, the agent would, or the producer would calculate what percentage of that risk is in Oregon, and then what percentage of the risk was in Idaho, and what percentage was in Montana, and all these states. And then that, he would then calculate what percentage of premium, and then he would calculate the tax for each of those states, and he would then file paperwork in each of the states and send them the tax owing on that policy. Now, Dodd-Frank does not allow that. Dodd-Frank requires that only the home state can tax the full amount of can tax the multi-state policy. So in our in that situation, we could tax the all 10 states, but we would tax it for Oregon, and then they the Dodd-Frank bill contemplates that we would have interstate agreements with each of these states, whereby we would send for those policies where Oregon was the home state, we would tax the whole thing, and then we'd send Idaho their share of the money. For those in the interstate agreement or compact would be with Idaho, and say Idaho would agree that they would also send us taxes where they're the home state. I will tell you that we are the home state in less of these instances than we are would be the recipient of taxes from somebody where the home state was a different state. So for us not to do this might cost us a fair amount of money. The question is, in all of these things, and we don't know the answer, but the question is, how many states will actually sign these interstate agreements? I mean, there will be states like Texas who are large winners if they can tax the full amount of policies for companies domiciled in Texas that do business in and around the Gulf in many states. They may now have the ability to tax those and not sign interstate agreements with people and just keep the money. And so it's going to take a lot of cooperation to make this work.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Burrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have three questions.
Please.
If I might
yeah.
ask. One is the effective date. I didn't see it, and I don't have the dash 2 here, but what is the effective date of this?
Well, we did not put the emergency clause on this bill, co-chairs and Representative Brewer. So the effective date of this bill, as it sits today with the dash 2 amendments, would be January 1 of 2012. The Dodd-Frank bill does become effective July 21st, and we talked about the wisdom of trying to move the effective date up. We're not going to be able to have everything in place that we would need, including administrative rules and all of the processes of how this is going to work by July 21st, regardless. So we could move it up to September. And still give the insurance division time to write those rules. We weren't sure if it was worth the effort. We only have about 100 people that actually write this kind of insurance, and so our thought was that we can send the insurance division with our help could send a letter out to all of the agents who write this kind of thing, letting them know exactly how to proceed in the interim until it's fully effective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question is, what happens if we implement changing to this scheme where we're taxing 2% of the complete policy for all Oregon home state insured clients, or just the insureds, whatever the proper terminology is, but we implement it before the Interstate Uniform Compact is achieved? What does that do to us, and does that create a liability for Oregon?
what happens there? Because then we have a payout to other states at some point for a compact that's coming in the future. So how does that work?
Co-chairs, Representative Brewer, I believe that if we taxed a 10-state policy and taxed for all 10 states, that we would have the authority to keep the money if we wanted. And the interstate agreements would dictate how that money would be shared. In other words, you could write an agreement or a compact that would say and call for the paying out of taxes previously collected under the multi-state provision.
Or not.
So it's that's an up in the air issue then. And one other question then. Can you speak? I'm happy that both the insurance division and the surplus line providers producers have are harmonious on the Dash 2 amendments. Can you speak to the impact on the insured's interests? How does this change impact them, if at all?
Co-chairs, Representative Brewer, I spoke with Gary Bauer, who represents the Northwest Natural Gas, because they, this was in a follow-up to our chat yesterday regarding that issue, and he was unable to get a hold of their risk manager to. Otherwise, we'd have had somebody from their organization here today, or at least a written statement. He has not had, Gary says he's not had any negative feedback at all from his folks. I don't believe that this really changes very much for the insureds. They will be paying the tax that they normally would have paid anyway under the present scheme. They'll be paying it in a somewhat different manner. For the insureds, as to the fire marshal's tax, the insureds, it's so much simpler that at the very least insureds will be able to understand what we did now, which I'm pretty sure most of them didn't before. But I don't see any negative impact on any of the insureds here at all.
I think I'm beginning to get a sense of what this proposal is, and I think the next question is relevant to it, but I'm not certain. What are the rates on similar situations in our neighboring states, and are they significantly different from Oregon, and what effect would that difference have on our relative positions vis-a-vis this new federal law, if any?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Barnhart, because you chair this committee, I came prepared.
Good. You knew I was going to ask this question.
I knew you were going to ask that question. The rates for surplus, every state has a premium tax on surplus line. And the rates run from 1% in Iowa to 9% in Puerto Rico.
How much is Texas?
Texas is 4.85%. And most of the average is about 3%. So we're a little bit low. A little bit lower than the average.
So let me get to the point I'm trying to
get
to. It doesn't sound, based on what you just said, it doesn't sound like this is likely to be an added incentive for Oregon-headquartered businesses to move.
No.
Because we're lower, even when we add a tax that they don't pay now, we're lower than most other states. And it's a very small tax.
Mr. Co-Chair, we are lower than most states. Not most, but we are lower than the average, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
California's at 3%, for instance, okay, and we're at 2. I'm jumping back to something you just said. You said we're adding a tax that they don't pay now, but we're not really adding a tax that they don't pay now. We're just collecting a fire marshal's tax differently than we presently do.
Well, now, maybe I misunderstood, but I thought I heard you say that there's certain categories of surplus line insurance that don't pay a tax now, but that would pay a tax under this bill, and that the Dodd-Frank bill contemplates that they would pay a tax.
The independently procured insurance,
right.
And most states tax independently procured insurance. That's up to the states.
Mm-hmm.
We have not had a statutory authorization to collect tax on those policies.
Mm-hmm.
These are very, very large corporations that independently procure insurance, and most of them expect to pay that tax and pay it in most states. So the amount of money that they would be paying, these are companies that do business probably in all 50 states and other countries as well. So the 2% of the Oregon exposure that they would pay now is pretty insignificant in the overall scheme of things. I mean, I think, you know.
So essentially, if I'm understanding right, you're setting this up in contemplation of an interstate compact.
Yes.
In which other states where these large corporations are headquartered would send us money because they've made an agreement in an interstate compact to do so. After collecting the entire amount of the tax in that state based on this new federal law.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
You get it.
I'm just making sure that
this is complicated stuff.
Well, I want to make sure I understand the implications. Also trying to figure out why you're here recommending a tax that has to do with the line of business of the people you're representing, and I think I now understand that too, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up on that line of questioning, so Texas collects 4%. When they allocate the Oregon risk to Oregon, what rate is it?
2%.
Because they look at our rate.
Yeah. Well, co-chairs, Representative Benz, I don't believe that there's a lot of stuff here in the Dodd-Frank bill that is not spelled out in specific language. That might surprise you that Congress would do something like that, but our tax is 2%, so I don't think that we have authority to collect more than 2% on anything. And we don't have authority. That's one of the complications that Dodd-Frank has brought about that I wasn't going to get into in great detail is that these varying rates, we can tax policies at 2%. We can't, it's unconstitutional for us to tax an Oregon risk at 2% and an Idaho risk at 3% if we're taxing it. And so we're going to have to tax it 2%. This is, Dodd-Frank leaves us no alternative. We're going to tax at 2%, and then we're going to send Idaho 2% because we can't collect 3% for them.
But to go back to Texas, they've collected 4% on the entire risk.
Yes. Yes.
And they send us 2%, and they retain the balance.
Absolutely.
Even though the risk is in Oregon.
Co-chairs, Representative Benz, yes.
Hmm.
And in my view, it's a flaw in the thinking of people in Congress when they enacted this provision that they didn't really take into account the varying rates as they should have. There's no easy answer to it. A state like Texas is going to pocket some money.
Well, of course, a state like Texas has a lot more members of the United States House of Representatives than a state like Oregon does.
Yes, they do.
Thank you. It may not be a flaw from their point of view at all.
Yeah,
<true.
laughs> right. Exactly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on that dialogue, for Oregon-based businesses, though, because Oregon has a lower rate, this is actually a cost savings to them. So we will collect at 2%, and they will save on the increased differential to the other states where they were currently paying a premium to them.
Correct.
So that is a possible good thing for Oregon businesses.
Interesting. Thank you. That adds to the comment I made earlier about
right.
headquarters.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I hadn't gotten that far. That's helpful. Other questions? Without consultation with my co-chair, my suspicion is that we're going to try to move this bill. So please review the Dash 2 amendment carefully and get any questions you have ready. And I do appreciate very much the two of you coming together, reaching an agreement about where you want to go, not including any members of this committee in your work group. We appreciate that very much.
Well, let me say that Teresa made that very easy for us.
Thank you.
We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else would like to be heard today on House Bill 2679? I didn't think so. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2679 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3626.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3626 would allow a person to claim a special assessment for farmland if it's been used in farming for less than 5 years, if the person presents a plan to make sufficient farming-related investments in property. The measure also directs the Department of Revenue to adopt rules for the administration and enforcement of the requirements by county assessors and the process and timelines for the presentation of the investment plan. Currently, the special assessment of farm use applies to land in exclusive farm use zones if it's used exclusively for farmland. In cases where land is not in an exclusive farm use zone, it can still qualify for the farm use special assessment if it meets farm income requirements and complies with application requirements. This measure would allow farmlands in use for less than 5 years to qualify for the special assessment, even if they do not meet these farm income requirements, as long as the owner presents a plan to generate the required income within the first 5 years that the property is used for exclusive farm use. The measure also includes the provision that disqualification from special assessment would not occur if the plan is implemented in good faith but fails to produce the required farm income.
All right, thank you. Andrew Ainsworth. Good morning.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Ainsworth, and I'm here on behalf of Representative Peter Buckley, who could not make it today. House Bill 3626 was introduced by Representative Buckley on behalf of the Friends of Family Farmers organization. They're a coalition of family farmers, as one might expect. They're volunteer board chairwoman, Kendra Kambrowskis, was supposed to be here, but she is a working farmer, and her goats are kidding this morning. I don't know what that entails, but it sounds pretty complex. So, yeah, giving birth, apparently.
Be serious.
So this bill is one piece of a larger initiative that we introduced on their behalf and ran into some complications over raw milk. Who knew it was that controversial, but apparently it is. So we had to introduce this separately. And right now, if you meet certain income requirements in the third year of owning a farm, you can apply for a farming special assessment. And we're hoping to change that to allow young and emerging farmers to claim or qualify for the farming special assessment in their first year of farming to help them retain some much-needed cash to invest into the startup of their operations. And I've heard that farming requires quite a bit of startup costs, and I know that Kendra mentioned to me offhand one time that had she and her husband been able to qualify earlier, they would have used the money that they passed on to the state to build a much-needed greenhouse on their property in their early years of farming. And Representative Buckley, you know, is very focused on job creation this session in addition to the budget. And farming does represent a, you know, large portion of Oregon's employment base. And so anything we can do to encourage a new generation of farmers to, you know, kind of commit, lay down a plan for investing in their farm operations and helping them get off the ground is something that he's very supportive of. And, you know, I'm not a expert in taxation, so I can't necessarily speak to the types of investments or income amounts that the Department of Revenue or Department of Ag might want to see, but I'm happy to answer any questions about why we brought this bill forward.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you. This this basically is saying for farms less than 5 years that won't be meeting the income requirements immediately, as long as that they are allowed this special assessment if they have plans to generate the required income within the first 5 years. Can you tell me what those income requirements are?
Co-Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Brewer, no, I don't know the current income requirements under ORS 308A.068. I believe that's where that would reside. Hopefully somebody from the Department of Revenue might be able to tell you that.
Let's let staff answer that one.
I believe, Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Brewer, I believe that the income requirements are on the order of around $600 a year in farm income for croplands, approximately like 1 to 6 acres, and then it's on the order of about, $100 per acre. Yes, about $100 per acre for any cropland that's over six or farmland that's over six acres, and so there's the requirement is that the income come from some sort of farm use and sale of farm products. And
this is gross revenue.
It's gross revenue, correct. It's not a profit or anything like that.
Yeah, Representative Brewer.
The only concern, well, getting into the details and looking at the income levels being so low, this is more of a comment. Having a lot of farmers.
But we do have some additional witnesses.
Okay, I would like to hear that because I'm concerned about that. And, yeah, I would like to hear from the other witnesses then. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? I have one, and I think I know the answer to it already. The way this thing is set up, if a young farmer puts together a plan that conforms to the rules that are adopted by the Department of Revenue in consultation with the Department of Agriculture to essentially to establish a farm.
Mm-hmm.
We assume that there's not a farm there now, that they're taking some land and or they're putting some land to a different use than perhaps it was being used for before, and they're going to start a farm. And they have a plan that would get them to the level of gross income per acre that's required for the farm use tax special assessment, and then if they make it, fine, they now qualify for that special assessment because they're like everybody else; they have the proper gross amount of income for farm production. If they don't make it, then, if I understand the language on page 3 correctly, they simply stop getting the special assessment, but they're not required to pay back the amount that they were given in the special assessment, the reduced amount they were given in special assessment during the first 5 years. So have I got that right?
Co-Chair Barnhart, the Department of Revenue suggested some language, and I believe it's on page 7, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
And hopefully John Phillips can speak to this if I don't answer the question well enough. But the farmer would need to meet those requirements, and if they fail to implement the investment plan in good faith, then the Department of Revenue could seek to collect those back taxes.
Right. But if they worked in good faith and simply didn't make it, they would not collect those back taxes. But the key point to me is the farm assessment would not continue after the 5 years, despite the fact that they had worked in good faith to try to get there. Is that right?
That is my understanding, but right. I'm not an expert.
So what we're really saying is we'll go in with you for the first 5 years to the extent of taxing you at the special assessment rate rather than the regular rate. But and if you work hard and try to make it happen, you'll get that special rate. Mm-hmm. If you're successful, you get to keep it because, of course, then you now qualify mm-hmm. under the normal rules. If you don't keep it, we won't ask you to pay back the tax that we didn't collect. Have I got that?
I'd say that's a fair assessment. And the key point here is that right now you have to wait till year three to qualify for this. So we're moving this up to year one just to put that much-needed cash in your pocket to invest into your okay. into your farm.
So the current rule is I start a farm. Mm-hmm. Even if I meet the requirement the first year, I don't get the tax break. I only get the tax break in the third year, and then only if I actually meet the gross sales requirement. Mm-hmm.
That is my understanding.
Under the current rule. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think I get the thing now. Any further questions? Thank you. Let's hear from Bob Broman and Douglas Schmidt. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? Thank you. Why don't you come up, too? Jody. Gentlemen, while she's coming up, why don't you go ahead?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Bob Roman. I'm the Clackamas County Assessor. I'm also the president of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. And we're not supporting this bill at this point for a number of reasons. And it starts, I think, with kind of an overview of what we hope the legislature would consider when considering new programs. I had the opportunity to work with Representative Nathanson on her efficiency and effectiveness task force as an advisor on the assessment and taxation subcommittee. And you've heard some of the bills that have come before you that came out of that committee. There were other recommendations, and one of them certainly was that there were concerns that each unique either exemption or, in this case, special assessment does have administrative costs and certainly adds to the complexity of the property tax system. And one of the things that I think the legislature has been striving for and looking to is making this system as effective and efficient as it possibly can. And we certainly discussed that we would hope that when new exemptions or special assessments came before the legislature, that they would look very hard, that there was a demonstrable public benefit to approving those types of programs. To get to this program specifically, and what I gave to the committee today, if you've received it yet, is a map of Clackamas County. And it shows in two shades of green. The light green are tax-exempt properties, and the darker green are specially assessed farm or forest properties. Now, this looks probably much like a number of counties in the state of Oregon, and the state of Oregon in general, if you were to view a statewide map of exemptions and properties that were specially assessed. And what we wanted to emphasize is, again, that these programs all cumulatively have an impact on the administrative costs of the counties and certainly the assessors that administer these programs, as well as having a revenue impact to local districts because oftentimes these will result in less money going in to support the services that are very important at the local level, including education, public safety, human services, many of the types of services that the state provides. To speak specifically to this bill, I would suggest to this committee that the legislature has already made it very, very attractive and relatively simple to qualify for special assessment, even if your property is not located in an exclusive farm use zone, where that qualification is automatic if you're farming it. The income requirement is pretty much as Ms. Broniak described. It's really $650 minimum gross income, $100 per acre, and a maximum of $3,000 of gross income qualifies you for special assessment. And these properties can be located in any type of zoning for the most part. They're not limited to areas that are zoned, for instance, exclusive farm use or general agricultural district. So some of the concerns...
Could you back up just a second?
Mm-hmm.
And explain the sentence that you just made a moment ago about exclusive farm use land.
Yes.
I think what you said was it automatically qualifies.
Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, that is correct.
So it doesn't matter whether you make any money at it or not?
When a property is located in an exclusive farm use zone, very restrictive in some of the uses you can put the property to, as long as the property owner is farming with an intent to make a profit, whether he's making a profit or not, that property will qualify for special assessment as farm use.
And that's the current law?
That's the current law.
Okay, so a young farmer going into a exclusive farm use zone and intending to farm and actually farming qualifies now
immediately
on year one.
That's correct.
So this rule only applies in other land?
Chairman Barnett, that's correct.
This bill would only make changes in terms of non-exclusive farm use zone land.
Chairman Barnett, that is correct.
Thank you. Please, go ahead. I want to make sure I got that right.
Right. So again, just to kind of reiterate, we think that the to qualify for special assessment is already something that is well within reach of most people intending to farm. And we would certainly have some concerns about, again, having to monitor whether a program qualifies or not based on investment rather than actually farming that property and producing gross income. And I can, if you would like, explain just a little bit of the process that we use to oversee, because as an assessor, we're required to monitor that properties within these programs continue to meet an income requirement. So on an annual basis, we will actually contact property owners that have qualified for special assessment and are meeting an income requirement, mail out an income questionnaire, have them respond, and if they don't respond, we again contact them requesting that they give us some information which would lead us not to consider disqualifying them from the program. And it may even go to the point of actually having to disqualify them or send a letter of disqualification before we'll actually receive income information that shows that property may still qualify. So there is a significant amount of administration that goes on in just monitoring these programs to make sure they qualify, because again, their tax obligation is less for that property than it would be if it were not specially assessed.
How many, I'm sorry, let's go ahead and, well, I'll ask questions and others also after the others have testified, please.
Chair Barnhart, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor, and I'm testifying against the bill today. I believe that the bill will cause more work for my staff and more costs for my office. We will need to track the progress of the investments that have been identified in the plan. which could require reporting by the taxpayer and tracking by my office. We will need to physically check and verify that the necessary investments have been made each year, as again as identified by the plan. And the reason for this is, if the plan is not implemented, or if the property does not meet the income requirements down the road, and we try and disqualify the property, we have to support our decision to disqualify that with documentation and pictures. So if somebody does not follow their plan and meet their plan, then we need to document that over that first 2 years that it's in effect. And we would have to present that to the courts if they decide to appeal our decision. Another area that I believe that it will cost us time and money is if a person submits a plan that they believe meets the requirements of the statute or the rule, and I don't believe it does, then I'm assuming that they would have a right to appeal. We would have to support that, document that, defend that. Or if the person, like I said before, the person is granted the deferral, but they don't implement their plan as laid out, then they can appeal, and we would have to also defend that. So there's just a lot of additional time and effort to document and support something that is an intent to farm. And we have enough properties, like Mr. Roman said, that we have to monitor on a yearly basis, not just the non-AFU properties, but we also monitor the exclusive farm use properties to make sure they're farming. That to track something and monitor something that isn't being used for farming, possibly for those first 2 years, is just an additional burden on us that we have to implement. I would kind of question, in the statute or in the bill, it talks about if a farm unit has been in farm use for less than 5 years and does not qualify for farm use. Hopefully I don't have to repeat all that testimony.
Oh, no.
if someone has been using a property for less than five years in farm use, which is defined as the current employment of land for the primary purpose of obtaining a profit in money, if they haven't been able to prove some income off of that property in those years, then maybe this isn't a farm property. And just by filing a plan doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to make an income off of this property. And as Bob said, the income requirements on these properties are very minimal. If a farmer now this is my own personal opinion because I come from a family of farmers. If a farmer in an EFU area was making gross income of $100 an acre on their property, they wouldn't stay in business. These are very minimal requirements. And in fact, if an owner in a non-EFU area leases their land to a farmer to farm, they only have to rent it for $25 an acre. $25 an acre is all that they have to get off of rent for that property, which is minimal. Rents are anywhere on good farmland are anywhere from $100 to $180. I would like to make a few comments that if the committee decides to proceed forward with this bill, I think there are some areas that need to be cleared up. There are some questions, and if I could, I'd like to at least get those on the record. They may not be done today, but if you decide to go forward with this, in my understanding is in Section 2, where it talks about a property being in farm use for less than 5 years, in lines 8 and 9, then when you go down to lines 13 and 14, it talks about after they file a plan within the first 5 years that the farm unit is used exclusively for farm use. I believe those are two separate issues, that once the person files the plan, then they have 5 years to meet the 3 out of 5 year income test. That would be how I would read that, but it is a little confusing there. They could have farmed it up to the point of filing the plan, but they didn't meet the income. Now they file a plan, and it sounds like they get another 5 years to meet that income test. So it's just a clarification point. When does that 5 year window start? When they file the plan 5 years forward? Or is it a cumulative 5 years for all the time they've been farming the property?
And I think the intent was that it's just from the time they file the plan, they move forward. The second area is, if you look in Section 4 on, lines 11 and 12, Section 4, lines 34 and 35. It talks about that if the investments required by the investment plan for the land have been met, is when you can apply. But in Section 2, it only talks about filing a plan in order to qualify for special assessment. So I think there's some conflicting language there, that if the intent of the bill is only that the person has to develop a plan and file a plan for investments, that they start their deferral that day, that is actually different than what is stated in Section 4, where it says that the plan has to have been met before they can get the deferral. So just a clarification. And I don't know if the intent of the bill was to allow a person, if they file a plan and they don't qualify either through income or they don't meet their plan, and the county disqualifies them, if they can turn right around and file another plan and get deferral. That's not stated. The way it's stated in the disqualification portion, I believe it is Section 6, it just talks about requalifying under the normal requalification process, and it refers back to what is currently Sections 2 and 3, or Section 2, where you just file a plan and you can get under deferral. So again, I don't want to see this as a rolling thing, that maybe it's a one-time thing, unless the bill was intended to just let him keep filing plans and getting deferral, which I don't think was the intent of the plan. I think it was getting somebody started in farming and giving them the benefit of that.
Right. The head shake from Mr. Ainsworth suggests to me that Representative Buckley did not intend
the requalification refers back to what would have been a requirement to prove 3 out of 5 years of income before he can apply. That's been removed, it's still there, but it's been replaced with a plan. But I do think, in closing, that the legislature has had in place rules and that have allowed small acreage farmers, and that's what these will be, anywhere from 2 acres to 20 acres, 40 acres it may be, very low qualifying standards in order to get the deferral. It's just that they don't get it right away. But part of that is, I think, it shows whether or not that person is going to be able to farm that property and with making that minimal income standard. And on small properties, small farmland, sometimes it's hard to do that. But I think that 3-year period that you have to prove 3 years of income prior to qualifying shows that you're able to do that on that property. And I think the legislature had implemented those rules and statutes, and they've been working well for a long time, and I just would hope that they would continue with those.
Thank you. You want to talk about slightly different issues, I suspect, don't you, Jody?
Slightly, no.
Thank you. So why don't we take questions for the assessors now, and then we'll hear from you. Questions for the assessors. Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you. It requires them... They don't have to pay it back if they filed the plan in good faith. What does good faith mean to you? How is that problematic or not problematic to you as county assessors?
Chairman Barnhart, Representative Eric Brewer, I think it's problematic. It's very subjective and very discretionary as to what is good faith. And I think that that's one of the potential difficulties with the way the bill is drafted.
Co-Chair Barnhart, Representative Brewer, I agree. That's where some of our additional work is going to come in, is that we may not believe that plan has been implemented in good faith or adequately, according to how they filed it, or... and that's where the disagreement is going to come in. So I think it is very vague, and it's a discretionary issue.
Yes, Representative.
The
Thank you. Another scenario, and my reasons for this being problematic are because there's a lot of folks that have hobby farms with no intent for profitability at all, and the income requirement doesn't require profitability, it just requires some sales. And one of the things in here that in current law says under Section 3B, fur-bearing animals, which says to me someone who's trying to breed a dog. And as we have, or cats or whatever it is, as we have small pockets of property that could have a conditional use, whatever it is, or outright permitted use in some of our more urban settings, we also have chicken farmers these days, depending on where you're at, that all of a sudden this could be used where it's really somebody's home, not really a farm, but that is an activity that they're doing there. Do you see that expanding the application, that this would expand that application to unintended purposes?
Again, Chairman Barnhart, Representative Eric Brewer, I think that you're very correct that would be a distinct possibility. Of course, that's really a policy matter of whether or not that would be something that the legislature feels that they want to encourage. I think that it might not be something that the serious farming community would think is an appropriate use that allows for special assessment as a farm property.
Thank you. There are questions. I have one. What's the special assessment worth in terms of a reduction in the normal property tax would otherwise be due?
Some information on that.
I mean, I don't need details, just a rough, does it reduce it by half or two-thirds, or what does it reduce it by?
Co-Chair Barnhart, I actually did a comparison of some properties in Polk County that were in the urban growth boundary or zoned as non-EFU land, and a lot of it depends on the location in the county. If you have a property that's outside the city limits of Salem that is getting farm deferral or not getting farm deferral, it could be substantial. So an example, a property in West Salem that had 15 acres, it's a savings of over $2,000 a year in granting the deferral versus not granting the deferral.
And how much are the taxes otherwise?
The taxes would have been, that I don't have. I just did the difference.
Yeah, what I'm really interested in is what percentage of the taxes that would normally be due does this reduce?
Well, here's an example. Yeah. Okay, the taxable value, the maximum assessed value on that property would have been $189,000. The taxable value under farm deferral is $5,000, a little over $5,000.
Wow.
So yeah.
Huge.
Now in an area that's not as expensive.
So it's about a 96% reduction.
Well, in this case.
No, 97% reduction.
Do the math.
Yeah.
I used to be able to do this. Now I've gotten used to calculators and computers.
Yeah.
In an area further west that isn't as expensive of land, you'd have a taxable value, if it wasn't under deferral, of about $65,000. Under deferral, it's about $1,200. So again, it has to do with the original market value of that property.
Mm-hmm.
The taxable value as farmland is the taxable value, whether it's a small piece or it's a 400-acre farm. It goes off of the rent income and a whole nother day I can spend talking about that.
Right.
So
no, I think that really helps me a lot understand that issue. And I don't know how much detail we need to go into. I had envisioned we were talking about a 20% decrease, but you're talking about almost the entire value of the property.
Depending on where the property is located, it can have a significant reduction in the taxes on a property.
Right.
But again, that is also an incentive for people to meet the income requirement.
Of course.
And
when the income requirement is fairly small,
yes,
it's worth a little effort to reduce the taxes by that large amount.
And on the property, as an example, Co-Chair Barnhart, on that property in West Salem, the West Salem Hills, 15 acres, actually a little more than 15 acres, they'd be required to produce $1,600 of gross income per year. gross income. Mm-hmm. So they could raise some cattle and sell them. Well, cattle's kind of a bad example. You have to take the price of the animal out. But say they farmed, sold some hay off of it for $1,600. They meet the income requirement.
Great. Thank you. That was really, that gets to the gist of what I was trying to understand. Are there other questions for the assessors? Let's hear from Jody Weiser, please.
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness, Oregon. I'm interested in this bill for two reasons. One, I think it opens up a question we really need to explore, and that is our support of hobby farming. Because it is not just in the property tax. It is also that when you have a hobby farm, you have hobby farm expenses. So you might be deducting $10,000 worth of expenses from that farm that you create $600 worth of gross income.
On your income tax.
Right. So right. We are costing property tax loss, and we are causing income tax loss by having it so easy to be called a special assessed farm. I don't know when the last time the $600 per acre figure came out, or $100 per acre gross income, when was that adjusted? You know, was that in 1975 that number was set, and it hasn't been increased since then? And so I think that it's a perfect bill to raise, to open up bigger questions. The other thing is, there's nothing in the bill that says what your investment plan might need to include. If I bought my neighbor's house, I would have enough trillium that I could easily harvest 100 to 200 trillium a year and make my $600. And I would really only need to invest in a special kind of shovel to harvest those trillium. And I might never get around to it, or I might find that the price of trillium is less than I thought and not make it, and yet I would have a special assessment for a property that is could be easily turned into buildable lots. And so I think that it really raises a question that we probably shouldn't address in this session, but we should address, because we are starving our school system while we are supporting people having ample property around their home, that they create both property tax and income tax reductions through their planning.
Thank you. Questions for Jody? One of the things I'd like staff to do is to let us know when these numbers were last adjusted. And I don't need to know that today, but when was it that these particular requirements that the assessors are using now, when were those numbers last adjusted or adopted, if they haven't been adjusted? I think we have opened up an interesting point, perhaps not the one that Representative Buckley had in mind, but... one question I have for the assessors, Jody talks about hobby farms. I know that's a term of art, and it's not a legal definition at all, but in your sense, do you have a lot of these? Is this a big issue, or is it a small issue? How would you characterize it?
Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, I'd say it's a significant issue, and it's certainly an issue that always raises concerns, especially with the agricultural community, because there's that sort of existence between those people that are seriously involved in farming as a livelihood, mm-hmm. and I think they're concerned about the impacts that people that may not necessarily be farming other than for a property tax reduction and potentially maybe some income tax benefit, but it's not necessarily their livelihood. Mm-hmm. And so that creates that sort of tension, I think, within that community. The other thing I might just add is that, you know, we refer to these as tax deferral programs, which in the context of what you were discussing earlier is that these monies all eventually may be paid back. It's just a deferral and not something that's really forgiven. The reality is that when a property ceases to be used in a manner that allows it to continue to be qualified, we'll only go back and collect those deferred taxes to a maximum of 5 years. So if a property's been specially assessed and farmed for 10 or 15 years, there is actually tax forgiveness there, because those prior years will never be collected. So it's kind of a hybrid between a deferral and really a program that allows for forgiveness of taxes on the property tax side.
Okay. Co-Chair Barnhart, I don't have...
And we're very much out of time, so keep it very brief.
Yeah, I don't have figures on the percentage of what these small acreages are, but they are substantial. No, well, there's quite a few of them in Polk County, and we spend a lot of our time on farm deferral issues on these small pieces. The large farmers, they farm it because that's their livelihood. They have to farm it. It's the smaller properties in non-EFU zones that we spend the majority of our farm-related issues on.
Well, if the two of you, without huge effort, if it's huge effort, don't do it. But if you could do it without huge effort, it would be really good to know what the numbers are of these hobby farms and what how many of them are inside an urban growth boundary.
And trending of it.
And the trends. Is this increasing? Is it declining? What's your sense of it? Also, if you have a sense of where the lines are between hobby farms, where it's really an attempt simply to reduce taxes without really being a significant income generator for a family, and the other side of the line where people are actually trying to make a go of it in farming. I know that may be difficult to do because, of course, we have a large number of truck farms that are direct sales farmers that work very small acreages but actually trying to make a living doing it. I know we do in my area. On the other hand, I know my daughter, who is farming the backyard of her house in the city of Eugene, does not plan to make any money doing this, and it would be astounding to me if someone in that situation might qualify for this kind of a deferral.
Chairman Barnhart, we'll try to provide you some of that information. I think you very appropriately explained that we need to be very careful because there are some very serious farm uses on smaller parcels. So, you know, we'll try to be careful in giving you something that's representative of the type of information that will
and
be
again,
helpful.
And again, please do not take a huge amount of time on this. But if you can do it without a gigantic effort, I think the committee would appreciate having the information. And I suspect, as Jody suggested, this is probably not a topic for this year. But who knows? It might be. We have a vehicle. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3626. We did not open another work session. Did I set that out forward?
Yeah, you need to carry over two work sessions, 2572 and 2328.
All right. We carry over 2572, House Bill 2520. I'm sorry. Say the number.
2572.
2572 and?
2328.
We'll carry those over to Monday. Colleagues, tomorrow is the Tax Credit Committee. Friday we're not meeting, so our next meeting is on Monday. Is that right? Okay, and with that, committee's adjourned.